to alarm you. It's not as if you're the only one who could identify these men. No, I really think it's unlikely there would be a deliberate leak. An accidental one, that's a different matter. Well, either way, everyone knows now. I'm the woman on the train who did nothing. Tough for you, then. Yes, but nothing compared to what that family has been through. So why on earth did you go down there, to Cornwall? I can feel the sigh leaving my body and put the coffee down for a moment, cradling my head in my palms. Completely stupid of me, I know. But the thing is, when I saw her, Mrs. Ballard, outside my shop, just watching me, I recognized her from the press coverage. It was in the local paper such a lot. Anyway, it gave me the creeps, and when I thought it over, I felt it would be better to try to talk to her. I got it into my head that if I told her in person how very, very sorry I was, and that I accepted she had the right to be angry, that if she could see that I was a mother too, and how terrible I felt about her pain... Matthew's face gives him away. Yes, I know. Stupid of me. And she reacted badly. Understatement. She went completely berserk. Of course, I can see it now. I was being selfish. I had this fantasy in my head that if she could just see that I was a decent person and that I so badly regretted... Was anyone else there? No, just the two of us. I took some flowers, a big posy of primroses, which I read were Anna's favourites, which I can see now was probably the trigger. Made it so much worse. She became quite hysterical. Said she was sick of flowers and I had no place, no right. Floral tributes as if her daughter were dead, which she doesn't believe she is, incidentally. Matthew pours some more frothy milk into his coffee and offers me the same, but I put my hand over the cup. Do you think it's possible that the girl is still alive? Matthew tightens his lips. Possible, but statistically unlikely. That's what we think, me and Tony. For a moment my voice falters. I wish that I could feel more hopeful. I think of a recent television drama in which missing girls were found years later. I try to picture Anna emerging from a basement or a hiding place with a police blanket around her shoulders, but I cannot shape the scene in my mind. I cough, looking away to the wall of filing cabinets and then back, picking up my coffee cup once more. So anyway, it was pretty terrible in Cornwall. I tried to leave, apologizing for disturbing her. She rather lost it. Physically. She wasn't herself. Did she hurt you, Ella? I mean, if she hurt you, if she's volatile, then you really ought to go to the police with this. They should know this. She didn't mean to. A tussle on the steps outside, an accident more than anything. Just a bit of bruising on my arm. Matthew is now shaking his head. Oh, for goodness sake, it was my own fault. She's not a violent woman. It wasn't deliberate, and I should never have gone there. Provoked her. But the point is, it shook me up a bit. I mean, I knew that she blamed me, and I wanted to try to redress that. But the extent of her hatred, her eyes. Which is why you think the postcards are from her. Don't you? He shrugs, tilting his head from side to side. I wish you had kept them all. Sorry. I didn't want my husband to worry. He's going for a promotion at work and has enough on his plate. Look, Mr. Hill, sorry, Matthew, if you won't take this on for me, I will burn them. I'm not handing them in to the police, I can tell you that. Matthew examines my face very closely, then shifts position. I would like you to visit her, Matthew. You're neutral and experienced at this kind of thing. I am hoping that you can put a stop to this without upsetting her further. Gently warn her off, but without involving the police and making it all worse for her. And what if you have this all wrong, and it isn't her? This mother who seems to have a bit of a temper on her. Well, then I will reconsider and listen to your advice. Good. So we have a deal here, Ella. I try one visit to Mrs. Ballard to see what I make of the situation, and if I'm still uneasy, you consider passing all this on to the police. You don't seriously think this has anything to do with the investigation? In all honesty, probably not. If it's not the mother, it's most likely some saddo. but the team ought to be told. But my call... Okay, we regroup after I've been to Cornwall. And now he's frowning, narrowing his eyes as he stands. I take it you heard the new development, Ella, this morning. I'm sorry? On the local radio this morning, after the anniversary appeal. No, what development? Has someone come forward? I missed it. What's happened? Matthew winces. They haven't released a name, of course, but I'm assuming it's the other girl, on the train. The friend. Sarah. Her name is Sarah. What do you mean? What's happened to Sarah? Chapter 7. The Friend. Again, Sarah is pretending to be asleep, but this time it is more difficult. There are nurses to deal with, not just her mother. Come on, Sarah. We need you to try to have a little drink, yes? The nurse is gently tapping her hand. Go away. Go away. Why can't you just keep her on a drip? Her mother has been clucking and fussing and crying alongside the bed for most of the night. She looks terrible. She can't sit up. Trust me, it's better for Sarah if we can get her to stay alert and take a little drink herself. They are on a unit called HDU, which Sarah learns stands for High Dependency Unit. She has been conscious of the goings-on around her for several hours, but has been feeling woozy and playing dumb. They want to know precisely how many tablets she took. They keep asking this. She has listened in on conversations between the medical staff and her mother. Tests are apparently underway to determine how many tablets, but they take time, and it would be much easier, everyone explains, if Sarah would just tell them. The nurses have been trying to get her mother to take a nap in the family room, and Sarah wishes so badly she would agree. She feels too tired and dazed and wretched to feel guilty. She is sick to her stomach of feeling guilty. She just wants everyone to leave her alone. Her mother is now telling the nurses that the last time they were in hospital was over an asthma attack when Sarah was in primary school. All the parents were allowed to bed down in the playroom next to the children's ward. They slept on mattresses on the floor, though some of them got the luxury of proper fold-up beds. This time there is no mattress or bed. Margaret spent the night like some ghost, wandering here and there to stretch her legs every few hours, alternating between the green plastic armchair alongside Sarah's bed on the unit and the closed cafeteria that offered filthy coffee and snacks from machines. Sarah is now vomiting less, still determined to say nothing. How many tablets, Sarah? We need to know how many.
I don't have many in the house. Paracetamol. 2 packets, tops.
Sarah's mother repeats this to the staff for the umpteenth time. The truth? Sarah doesn't remember how many tablets she took. She bought some at the corner shop and some at the supermarket. They have stupid rules about how many you can buy in each place. It was the thought of the TV reconstruction, the push for new witnesses, that stupid bitch on the train. Over and over she had told the police and her parents that it was all vicious lies. Have sex in a toilet with a complete stranger? What did they think she was? How dare they? But later, Sarah had panicked. What if the TV show led to more witnesses? The whole case had gone quieter since the immediate aftermath of Anna's disappearance. And of course, she wanted people to help the police. Of course she wanted Anna to be found. She just didn't want anyone to find out the truth about her part in it all. Not that. Please, not that.
Do you think we had better get the doctor again? Maybe a consultant? See what he thinks?
I'm following the doctor's very specific instructions. Please try not to worry. Sarah has stopped vomiting, and it's best we try to get her to take in some fluids herself. Trust me, it's best for her. Then we can get a better idea of where we are.
And what does where we are mean?
Sarah's mother is all agitation.
Shut up.
Sarah cannot help herself. Barely a whisper.
Just shut up, will you? All of you.
There we are. Good girl, Sarah. Come on, then. Let's try opening your eyes, and then we can see if we can sit you up a little bit, yes?
We should have the test results back soon, let you know how you're doing, but it would be a great help. I don't know how many I took, right? I just don't know.
I think we should just leave her. Please.
Sarah's mother begins to cry, and Sarah can feel tears forming on her own face. She wishes Lily were here, but cannot say this to her mother. Yet another taboo subject.
I'm sorry.
You have nothing to be sorry for, my darling. It's going to be fine. Everything is going to be fine, I promise you. Everyone sends their love, Anna's parents, Jenny and Paul and Tim and everyone. They just want you to get well.
Sarah closes her eyes.
Not true, is it? Truth is, they blame her. They'd said as much. The night before the wretched TV program, they had all got together, supposedly for moral support, but it had all gone badly wrong. Spiraled down and down into this ugly place until there was a shouting match. The two boys really angry. Jenny crying. The thing was, they were all supposed to go to London. All five of them. Anna and Sarah to celebrate the end of GCSEs in school uniform, and the older ones for fun. But it was like everything they tried to do. People were so flaky. When they were little, it was very different. The age gap never seemed to matter. Jenny and the two boys were 2 years ahead in school, but so what? Then, in secondary school, when the older ones got part-time jobs, everything changed. They had more money, suddenly. They wanted to do different things, and they started bailing on plans. Sarah hated all the change. She especially hated people flaking out on things, and she spat out her anger in the row.
If you hadn't all been so selfish, made other plans, maybe I wouldn't have been trying to look after Anna in London on my own.
Paul had caved on the trip first. Offer of a week in Greece, villa with a pool with his parents. Tim bailed next, mad keen on walking. He was offered a trekking week in Scotland and wanted to see the Loch Ness Monster Museum. Also didn't fancy being the only bloke on a girl's trip. And then Jenny had the offer to see a band with her then-boyfriend. And so it was only Sarah and Anna.
You should still have looked after her.
The boys were both furious.
We don't understand how you got split up.
And then Jenny, wondering why they didn't have the usual pact, watching each other's back.
I mean, it was London, for God's sake!
Sarah had wanted them all to shut the hell up. In any case, why was she the one who was expected to look after Anna? Why not the other way around, eh? Because Sarah was from the estate and supposed to be more streetwise. Because Anna could be a bit of a princess. Was that it? Of course, they'd had a pact. It was Anna who broke it, she shouted at them. All of them. At Tim, with his selfish trekking holiday. Paul with his fancy villa. Jenny with her gig. She spat the lie at them, just as she had spat it over and over to the police. We said we would meet at the bar at 2 a.m. for a taxi to go home. She didn't show. Anna broke the pact, okay? Anna didn't show. I told you, I told you, I told you! Her mother had tried to calm her about the TV program. The woman on the train wouldn't be allowed to make false claims. Not on television. It was libelous. She's obviously some kind of weirdo. But Sarah was petrified. What if other witnesses now came forward? From the train or from the club? She remembers her father's reaction at the Paradise Hotel in London. At first, she refused to talk to him. It had been years since he left the family, and she'd refused all contact. But her mother wanted him there with everything that was happening, and he went mental when the DI shared what the witness had said.
You call him my daughter a slut?
And so Sarah had sat at home before the television program, terrified about what would come out. She was supposed to be going to Jenny's, to the farmhouse, all of the friends together. But then all the images had started to flash through her mind. The club, that queasy feeling when she looked at her watch, the row with Anna.
Don't be such a baby!
The trouble with not telling the whole truth to the police was, sometimes, a year on,
She couldn't remember exactly what she had said and what she hadn't said. She was petrified that all this stirring it up would make her slip up and say the wrong thing. So she had taken the tablets into the bathroom and said she was having a bath. And it wasn't as if she made this clear decision that she wanted to kill herself. Nothing that dramatic, nothing that black and white. She just wanted the panic to stop, the waiting for the TV program, the not knowing how much they would find out. She just wanted all of it to stop. Now, as the nurse helps her to sit, plumping pillows up behind her, someone new appears alongside the bed. Another nurse, in a different colored uniform. She is older, looks more senior, and is talking to her mother. Ominous whispering. Something about the test. I didn't mean to make you jump. It's just the doctor would like a word. What is it? What's happened? It's best you come this way, please, Mrs. Headley. Chapter 8. The Private Investigator. On the drive down to Cornwall, Matthew phones home twice. It's just Braxton Hicks, Matt. I will ring if it changes. It's fine. Braxton Hicks. I can come back. Stay home if you'd prefer, if you're at all worried. I'm fine. Sally is 8 months gone and insists practice contractions are nothing to be alarmed about. Perfectly normal. But Matthew is no longer doing normal. He has found everything alarmingly abnormal since the surreal experience of the childbirth classes. Dear God, why had his friends not warned him? Are you sure you wouldn't prefer a cesarean, Sal? Some reckon they're a lot safer, you know. And these days you can say, no shame in it. Getting frightened, Matt? Sorry, but I'm not too posh to push, and it's a bit late to chicken out now. This whispered conversation had taken place with Sal, sitting on a yoga mat in her grey sweatpants and a black T-shirt, with Matt following instructions on how to massage her back, thinking how very lovely but also slightly ridiculous she looked. From behind, she looked her normal slim self, just this huge balloon stuffed up her top. Sal was the envy of everyone in the class. How come you've not swollen up all over? The others displayed their puffed-up ankles and their puffed-up legs, pinched the fat padding around their backs and their arms. God knows, I'm eating like a horse. This is true. Matthew had never seen his wife pack away so much. Fish finger sandwiches late at night with mayonnaise and chopped gherkins. The stench of her farts these days was mind-boggling. Piss off, Matt. I don't fart. I am a pregnant goddess. Matthew checks his phone one more time and smiles. Truth is, Sal even farts in her sleep now. The phone confirms a strong signal. No text. Could he ring just one more time? No. Calm down, man. She was getting prickly, the second call. Everything is going to be just fine. Not long to go. Matthew checks the sat-nav, less than a quarter of a mile to the Ballard's farm, and pulls into a lay-by. Mel should be in the office by now. Good. D.S. Melanie Sanders, hopefully soon to be D.I. Melanie Sanders, is Matthew's dearest police pal from the old days. There was a time, a million years ago, when he had a bit of a crush on her, had hoped for something more. But that was history. He told Sal all about it, came completely clean. No, that wasn't 100% true. He had not told her that he still got this slightly weird feeling in his stomach when he spoke to Mel. Not desire. Not that anymore. Just a feeling that reminded him of a whole different time, a different version of himself. 3 years out of the force, and Matthew hates to admit that he is struggling to adjust. He presses the button that links his dashboard to his phone and listens to it dial and ring. D.S. Melanie Sanders. How many copies have you had? Matt? I will ring off and ring back if you've not had your second caffeine hit. She laughs. You'd better not be after another of your favours. Of course I'm after a favour, but it's two-way, I promise. Oh, it's always two-way, Matt. I help you, and then I help you again. Now he laughs. Seriously, you up on the missing Ballard girl? Just the family liaison gig. One of our team, Kathy, is assigned to the family. We get updates from London, when they can be bothered, which isn't often. The DI on the case is a right little sir, between us. Why? So, any of the family ever in the frame, as far as you know? Mum and Dad in the clear? And why ever would you want to know that? No reason. You'd better not be meddling in a live case again, Matt. We all know where... Don't worry, if I have anything for you, I promise. Cross my heart and fingers crossed behind your back. You know me. They are both quiet for a moment. Every time they liaise like this, Melanie tries to persuade him to reconsider, to go back into the force. She still reckons it's an option despite all the water and the bridges, and swears that once she is sufficiently senior she will fix it, twist his arm. But Matt always turns it into a joke until they hit this silent little impasse, an understanding. She thinks he's wasting his talent, and he's frightened to think about that one too much. Okay, you didn't hear this from me, Matt, but word is the parents' marriage is not too hot. Hardly surprising. But no, family all have alibis. Our brief is just to keep an eye on them. The DI on the case. Did I mention he's a patronizing prat? Anyway, his focus is still finding the two guys on the train. Between us, there has been the usual cock-up liaising with our European friends. So, abroad then? Almost certainly. Not a squeak here. No leads at all. No forensics and nothing useful from CCTV either. The Met are a bit touchy. Bit slow putting the brakes on border controls. But the anniversary appeal brought in some calls, apparently. We're not being told much, but I shall push. Hope to know more soon. Why? Nothing. Look, we must have coffee sometime soon. I'll text you. So you really are meddling in a live case again? Moi? She laughs. Okay, and how's Sal before you ring off? Farting gherkins. Trust me, pregnancy is a smelly business. Seriously, she's great. Looks beautiful and serene as ever, but the gherkins are bad news. I'll text you about that coffee very soon. She is still laughing as he ends the call, checking the time on the sat-nav again. The Ballard's farmhouse is at the end of a half-mile single-lane track. It's like following the yellow brick road. The strange concrete surface in a sandy colour is raised above the dirt on either side, which puts Matthew on edge, wondering what the hell he's supposed to do if he meets another vehicle coming the other way. There are just two passing places along the whole stretch. Matthew is rather fond of his car, and is imagining the damage if a wheel slips off the side of the concrete platform. Could be very nasty. So this is what people mean by living off the beaten track. At the end of the drive, finally, he comes to the house. It's impressive. Double-fronted with a fabulous climber, no doubt magnificent in season, though he is no gardener and does not recognize the species. The inadequate approach widens into a full drive at the front of the house, with a large turning circle, an impressive lawn to the side, and a second track leading off towards barns in the distance. Matthew pulls up under a tree opposite the front door and puts his keys in his pocket. No need to lock up out here. Mrs. Ballard answers the door herself, which is a relief. A cliché in her floral apron. Matthew immediately feels guilty, forced now to look into those eyes. If you're a reporter, we have nothing more to say until the vigil. I'm not a reporter. Could we talk inside, Mrs. Ballard? Sometimes it works. Confidence and the official tone, as if he has the right. And you are... Not always. I'm a private investigator, Mrs. Ballard, and I'm looking into matters relating to your daughter's disappearance. Her face changes, from caution through surprise to a new hope so misplaced that Matthew feels guilty again. I don't understand. A private detective. So why are you involved? It would be better if we could talk inside. Please? In the hallway, they stand awkwardly as Matthew glances towards the vases of flowers, at least four crowding a narrow table below a large mirror. I wish people wouldn't send them flowers, but they mean well. We're having a candlelit vigil to mark the anniversary. She clears her throat, regroups. So I'm not quite understanding, Mr. Hill, Matthew Hill. You're investigating my daughter's disappearance privately, but why on earth would that happen? There's a whole team in London working on this. Did my husband call you? No, Mrs. Ballard. I was contacted by someone else touched by this inquiry, who is receiving unpleasant mail, and I'm just trying to help put a stop to that, so that all resources can be directed where they need to be directed, to finding your daughter.
Unpleasant mail? Would it be okay for us to sit down for a moment?
She stills herself, apparently considering this, and finally leads him into the kitchen. Another cliché, with its huge blue aga covered in drying socks. Mrs. Ballard appears a little more nervous now, her hands fidgeting in her lap. She does not offer a drink.
You haven't had any unpleasant mail yourself, I take it.
No, not at all. Lots of nice letters, actually, from complete strangers. A few weird ones, admittedly, but never a nuisance or a problem. We show them all to the family liaison officer, Kathy. She's still regularly in touch. So who's been getting unpleasant letters? Not Sarah, I hope. You know that she's in hospital.
Your daughter's friend from the trip?
Yes, I was there this morning, at the hospital. They're waiting on tests. Terrible. Terrible. Her mother's in bits. We all are. As if it wasn't all bad enough already. So is that what this is? Nasty letters to Sarah?
No. Not her. Matthew looks Barbara Ballard directly in the eye and checks for discomfort. But no, she does not look away. Her eyes just contain the ache of the haunted.
I know this will be difficult for you, Mrs. Ballard, but this mail, it's been sent to the witness on the train, Ella Longfield.
Oh.
Her demeanour changes immediately, along with her tone. That woman.
Yes, I am aware from Mrs. Longfield how you feel about her, and there is no intention, I assure you, of adding to your distress by bringing this up. But Ella is keen to try to put a stop to the mail without involving the police. She doesn't want them distracted from the main focus, finding Anna.
It late for that now?
I'm sorry.
She shrugs, staring at him now, more defiant.
Look, I understand it must be very, very tough, Mrs. Ballard, but I was in the force myself. There are good people doing their very best, I am sure of that. And the anniversary appeal. TV coverage normally helps to... She doesn't take the bait.
Look, these letters, whatever they are, it's probably better that you talk to my husband.
She is standing up.
He doesn't always hear his mobile and the signal isn't always great, but I can try giving him a ring if you like.
There's no need to disturb him. So you can't think of anyone who might send unpleasant mail to Mrs. Longfield? Anyone else in the circle who has been particularly upset about everything?
Spoken up angrily. About her part. Everyone's upset, Mr. Hill. My daughter is still missing. The vigil is tomorrow. And now, if you will excuse me...
She is belatedly pulling herself together, overriding her manners as she realizes, apparently, that she does not have to speak to him at all. Matthew knows from experience that this realization normally morphs swiftly into anger. He holds out his card, which she takes, hesitating for just a moment before placing it in the pocket of her apron.
Have you told the police team about this hate mail?
Mrs. Ballard is still looking him very directly in the eye.
Why do you ask that?
She does not reply.
Well, if you hear of anything which you think might be relevant, you will call.
Yes?
She nods.
The thing is, Mrs. Longfield is going to have to take this to the police if the mail continues, and that's not the way she wants to go. She thinks she will have enough to deal with.
Does she?
Matthew tightens his lips and nods a farewell. Outside, he can feel Mrs. Ballard watching him as he starts up the car and swings through a tight circle before pulling once more onto the impossibly narrow road. He checks the screen for his hands-free setup. Nothing from Sal. He tells himself not to look back, to keep the upper hand. And then he continues, steering ever so carefully and trying very hard to erase the image of Barbara Ballard's eyes.
Chapter 9. The Father. Henry sees the car approach the house as he is checking the sheep in the farm's highest and most exposed field. The wind is vicious up here, and he zips his coat right up to his chin, all the while watching the farmhouse below. This part of the farm has always been a problem logistically. Tricky to access except by quad bike, and Henry has always had a difficult relationship with the quad bike on the hills.
He has nearly turned it over more times than he will admit to Barbara. Once, on the steepest gradient, he seriously thought the stupid thing was going to topple right over at high speed. Two wheels left the ground, and he could feel the whole weight shift. It was just how they tell you, a flash of imagining, wondering how they would all cope when he left them behind. He hears the echo in his head again, Anna's voice. "You disgust me." That day with the quad bike had so frightened him that he went straight home and into the office alongside the boot room and arranged online to increase his life insurance. Later, it caused the most terrible row with Barbara.
"We can't afford more life insurance, Henry. What are you doing that for anyway? Don't be so morbid."
He promised he would cancel the extra premium while secretly wondering if he should reconsider the offer from a neighboring farm to take on the awkward fields, which were a better match for their own livestock. But it was a question of pride, still trying to pretend he was a proper farmer, not a tourist manager. He stands now watching the car leave, the driver clearly nervous of the access road, taking it slowly. No, Henry has decided he will not lease out or sell off any more of the land that his father and grandfather worked so hard to acquire. So what if the tourist side makes more sense on paper, the holiday lets, the campsite? He is still a farmer in his heart. And so he is thinking of his few sheep and his cattle, and also the increased life insurance premium still in place. He did not recognize the man who was just at the house, tall and slim, but too far away to make out his face. For a moment, Henry wonders if it was the police and experiences the familiar jolt of adrenaline. A year on, and unlike his wife, Henry is not waiting for their daughter to turn up alive. Henry watches Barbara emerge on the doorstep to make sure the visitor has gone. He's just thinking that he ought to head down there and find out what the hell is going on when there is a bleating behind him. He turns to see two of the ewes slipping on mud at the lower end of the field, sliding precariously close to the stream. Damn. He will have to go down there, encourage them up to the higher and safer ground. This exercise, with the ground so sodden, takes longer than he would like. Stupid sheep. No brains. He calls Sammy, who has his tail between his legs. Even the dog hates this field, looking at him now as if he were mad. "What are we doing up here? You normally bring the quad up here." Finally, with Sammy's help, he coaxes the two stray ewes and the rest of the flock back up onto the higher ground. From there he moves them further still, through the gate to the neighboring field, which, though poor on grass now, is a safer option for the night. He secures the gate, hauls Sammy back to his side, and finally heads along the adjoining lane back towards the farmhouse. It is called Primrose Lane. Anna used to love it when she was little, because of the high hedges, always keen to collect posies of wild flowers. "Race you, Dad!" Henry closes his eyes to this more welcome echo, and for a moment stands very still. He can picture her in her pink puffer jacket, with her pink bobble hat and her pink gloves.
"Come on, Dad, I'll race you back."
The posy of primroses in her hand. Only when he feels Sammy nuzzling at his leg does he open his eyes again. "Okay, boy. It's okay." He strokes the dog's head, takes a deep breath, and marches back home. By the time he reaches the farmyard, Barbara has gone back inside. In the boot room, he takes off his wellies, ordering the collie, covered in mud, to stay.
"So who was that earlier?"
Barbara's face is ashen as she comes through from the kitchen, wiping her hands on her apron.
"A private detective."
"What the hell is a private detective doing here?"
"He says that Ella, that flower shop woman, has been getting hate mail."
"So, what's new?"
"No, not just stuff on social media. Actual letters or something. To her house. Nasty."
"And this is our concern because..."
"I think this private detective thought I might have sent them."
"He accused you?"
"Not in so many words, but that was the implication. As if he was doing me a favor, warning me off."
Henry pauses,
narrowing his eyes. And before you ask, no, I didn't send them, though I can't pretend I give a damn who did.
Well, I hope you told him not to come back.
You think we should ring Cathy, or the London team? Tell them about this.
No, no point. I've told him not to come back. He says he's going to report it to the police himself.
And you didn't say anything else? Anything silly, Barbara? About me?
She looks at him very earnestly, unblinkingly, cold eyes. Henry can feel his pulse increasing.
No, Henry, I didn't say anything silly about you.
Henry sits on the old church pew which serves as their boot room bench.
Is Jenny home?
Not yet. She's gone into town. She wants a new coat for the vigil. Says she wants something warm and smart.
Henry has made his feelings about the vigil perfectly clear from the off. He is not a religious man. It was the local vicar's idea. Prayers and candles to mark the one-year anniversary. It had originally been scheduled for Thursday, a year to the day. But once the TV reconstruction was confirmed, they decided to put it back to the Saturday. More convenient for people, too, the weekend.
Barbara lifts up her chin. Sarah's mother is saying that she hopes we can put the vigil back until Sarah is well enough to attend, but I said that wasn't a good idea, that Sarah needs to concentrate on getting well. I think we should go ahead as planned.
And you still think this is a good idea, this vigil?
I have no idea, Henry, but people have been kind and they seem to want to do something. Also, the press will take photographs, which helps to keep it in the public eye. Cathy says that's good, to keep it in the public eye.
And what about Sarah? Is she still claiming it was an accident? The pills?
No one takes an overdose by accident, Henry is thinking. He tries to feel more sympathy for Sarah, but finds that he cannot.
Chapter 10. The Witness.
Why don't you let me make the tea, love? Give yourself 10 minutes for a change.
I hear my husband's voice, but do not turn. From the top of the stairs, I keep my eyes firmly fixed on the mail on the doormat. In the sweep of bills and white envelopes, I can see it, screaming at me. The familiar dark envelope, printed address on a cream label this time.
I'm fine, really. You know me. Prefer to get going.
I hurry down to grab the letters from the floor and bundle them into a pile, feeling the firm postcard inside the envelope and tucking it into the center as Tony begins his own descent of the stairs.
Are you sure you're all right, Ella? How about bacon butties? Tell Luke 15 minutes, would you?
I can feel my heart pounding in my chest and deliberately do not check my reflection in the hall mirror, not wanting to see the evidence, the flushed face. I really thought that by calling in Matthew this would stop. I honestly thought that I could avoid worrying Tony, who has been through quite enough already over all this. In the kitchen, I rifle through the mail to hand Tony the circulars from the wine club and the bank. I know that I should tell him, and I have promised myself that I will soon, very soon, once I've spoken to Matthew. But he is going to be upset again, and he's snowed under right now, bidding for this promotion. I feel bad, because he expressly warned me not to go to Cornwall. Oh, Lord. I had so hoped that Matthew would sort this.
Anything interesting?
Tony is looking at the mail in my hand.
Insurance company. Multi-car deal.
He pulls the face and turns away as I switch on the oven and begin busying myself with the bread and the bacon, just as the phone goes.
I'll get that,
I say, wondering if it's Matthew. I thought I asked him to ring me at the shop.
There's something going on, Ella, isn't there? Something you're not telling me. Not now, Tony, please. I'm fine.
Damn. If it's not the mother in Cornwall, we have to hand the mail over to the police. Right, I will have to tell Tony then. With one hand opening a new pack of bacon, I pick up the phone, bracing myself to ask Matthew to ring back later at the shop.
Is that Luke's mother?
Yes, Ella Longfield here. Who's this?
It's Rebecca Hillier, Emily's mother. I was hoping we could confirm arrangements for the meeting.
The meeting? I'm afraid I don't understand. There was a very long pause.
Has Luke not spoken to you?
No, is something wrong?
Look, there's no way I'm dealing with this on the phone. I made that very plain to Luke.
So, are you free tomorrow or not?
Tony is now mouthing questions. Who is it? What's the matter?
Well, my husband is playing poker with friends, so...
Let's say 7:30 p.m. at ours. Luke has the address.
And then she hangs up.
That's very odd. Very rude, actually. Get Luke down here, would you?
What's going on?
I wish I knew.
I begin to lay half a dozen slices of bacon on the tray, placing each one slightly overlapping so they just fit. With Tony's footsteps back on the stairs, I quickly open the dreaded envelope.
Watch yourself. I do.
Ella, I think you better come up here.
Dear God.
In Luke's room, I know immediately that things are bad, the dread switching instantly from the card to my son. These last couple of weeks, he has been running later and later for shifts at the shop and for school. There has been a letter from the school about missed lessons, too. The suggestion of a meeting with his tutor. I have been meaning to sort it out, but with so much happening.
What the hell's going on, Luke?
Tony is at first more cross than worried. Luke is curled up under the covers, fully dressed in yesterday's clothes. Jeans and a thick blue-green hoodie. Sweaty. Smelly.
You feeling cold? Going down with something?
I try to keep my voice calm, feeling guilty that my eye has been off the ball.
Start talking, Luke. What is all this about?
Tony is opening the curtains. Luke, his eyes dark and hooded, does not reply.
I've just had Emily's mother on the phone, going on about some meeting. She was quite off with me. Seemed to think I would know.
What meeting, Luke? I try not to sound angry. Still, he says nothing.
What is it, Luke?
And now I am panicking. I am thinking drugs, shoplifting, trouble with the police. No, not my Luke, surely. My straight A's Luke, who was supposed to be in with a chance of Oxbridge until all this nonsense just lately. A phase, Tony reckoned. A little rebellion, because the AS year was so much tougher than anyone expected. Maybe he's just sick of exams. Is that it?
Please, Luke, tell us what's going on. Maybe we can help.
Tony has softened his voice. And then Luke takes us both by surprise and starts to cry. Great, heaving waves of sobbing. Toddler tears, incongruous and dramatic, and at the same time terrifying from this fully dressed, 6'2" boy wraped in a blue-striped Marks and Spencer duvet. I know two things immediately. That whatever has happened is very serious, and that I have been too distracted by the Anna Ballard case to even notice.
Chapter 11. The Father.
Henry is putting the tractor into reverse when Barbara appears on the doorstep.
What the hell are you doing, Henry?
I'm getting things ready for your vigil.
My vigil?
Well, it certainly wasn't my idea.
There are a few minutes when she just watches him maneuver the tractor. Angry, jerky movements to and fro. He hopes she will go inside, leave him to it, but no.
I still don't understand what you're doing.
Putting out some bales of straw. Seating.
People won't want to sit down. They won't be here for long, surely.
People always want to sit down. There will be some older people who need to sit down, Barb. We can't put chairs out. I don't want them to get too comfy or we'll never get rid of them.
Oh, you're being ridiculous.
Henry is thinking that this is a fine time to call him ridiculous. He never wanted the stupid vigil. In bed last night, they had another spit-whispered row about it.
We could have it in front of the house, Barbara had said when the vicar called by.
Henry had quite explicitly said he would not support anything churchy, anything that would feel like a memorial service. But the vicar had said the idea of a vigil was exactly the opposite, that the community would like to show that they have not given up, that they continue to support the family, to pray for Anna's safe return. Barbara was delighted, and it was all agreed. A small event at the house. People would walk from the village or park on the industrial estate and walk up the drive. This was your idea, Barbara.
The vicars, actually. People just want to show support. That is what this is about.
This is ghoulish, Barb. That's what this is.
He moves the tractor across the yard again, depositing two more bales of straw alongside the others.
There, that should be enough.
Henry looks across at his wife and is struck by the familiar contradiction, wondering how on earth they got here. Not just since Anna disappeared, but across the 22 years of their marriage. He wonders if all marriages end up like this, or if he is simply a bad man. For as Barbara sweeps her hair behind her ear and tilts up her chin, Henry can still see the full lips, perfect teeth and high cheekbones that once made him feel so very differently. It's a pendulum that still confuses him, makes him wish he could rewind, to go back to the young farmer's ball when she smelled so divine and everything seemed so easy and hopeful. And he is wishing, yes, that he could go back and have another run, make a better job of it, all of it. Then he closes his eyes, the echo again of Anna's voice next to him in the car. You disgust me, Dad. He wants the voice to stop, to be quiet, wants to rewind yet again, to when Anna was little and loved him, collected posies on Primrose Lane, to when he was her hero and she wanted to race him back to the house for tea. Barbara is now looking across the yard to the brazier.
You're going to light a fire, Henry?
It will be cold, yes.
Thank you. I'm doing soup in mugs, too.
A pause then.
You really think this is a mistake, Henry? I didn't realize it would upset you quite so much. I'm sorry.
It's okay, Barbara. Let's just make the best of it now.
He slams the tractor into reverse and moves it out of the yard and back into its position inside the barn. There, in the semi-darkness, his heartbeat finally begins to settle, and he sits very still on the tractor, needing the quiet, the stillness. It was their reserve position, to have the vigil under cover in this barn if the weather was bad. But it has been a fine day, cold but with a clear, bright sky, so they will stay out of doors. Yes, Henry rather hopes the cold will drive everyone home sooner, soup or no soup. And now he thinks he will sit here for a while longer, actually. Yes, it's nice here, alone in the barn. He finds he does not want to move at all. A full hour later, and Jenny turns up in the kitchen to check on her mother, just as Henry finally takes off his wellies in the boot room.
You going to be okay for this, Mum?
Barbara is stirring two large stock pots of soup.
I'll be fine. It's just so difficult to know how many people will come.
Henry stares at her back. I'm sorry about earlier, love. I'm just a bit wound up.
It's okay.
She does not turn to look at him, but reaches out her arm to touch Jenny's shoulder for reassurance.
And how is Sarah doing?
Jenny takes in a deep breath.
She still wishes she could come. Her mum says she feels bad about missing this, and she's still saying it was an accident, the pills, but we all feel so terrible.
There is something about her tone that unsettles Henry. What do you mean, you all? It's very sad, but it's not your fault.
Jenny turns to her father. Well, maybe it is, actually.
What on earth do you mean?
We had a bit of a row with her, before the TV appeal.
Who's we?
All of us. Me and Tim and Paul.
Jenny's voice is now breaking up.
We've just been all over the place, with the anniversary, and with you guys arguing all the time. I don't know. I went round with the others to see Sarah to talk about watching the appeal together, and it all got a bit heated, a bit out of hand.
Go on.
I suppose we all feel bad for bailing on London. If we'd gone, there would have been more people to look out for Anna.
You can't think like that, Henry says.
But the trouble is you do, don't you? And so the boys were grilling Sarah again about why they didn't stick together at the club. What exactly happened to split them up? Why she's been so vague about it.
And now Jenny starts crying properly.
We didn't mean to make Sarah feel so bad.
We just got carried away. I mean, I bailed on the trip because of John and the gig, and I'm not even going out with him anymore. I can't believe I did that. Put a stupid boy ahead of my sister. We just all feel so guilty for not being there, in London, ourselves. But we shouldn't have taken it out on Sarah.
And this row happened when?
The night before the reconstruction on telly.
Which is why she took the pills, Henry is thinking. Jesus. Barbara's arms are now around Jenny.
Right. So, this is a pickle, sweetheart, she says. But we are all of us struggling to handle it. You're not to blame yourself. What you need to do now is to talk this through with Sarah properly. Explain that you don't blame her.
We don't. Not really. We just...
Upset, as are we all. I'll speak to Sarah's mum and see when you can visit her. Iron this all out. Now then, dry those tears and get your new coat. People will be arriving soon. I'm going to help you sort this out, I promise. You'll work this through with Sarah, okay? It's going to be all right. We just need to be strong now, tonight, for Anna. Yes?
Henry is looking at his wife and wondering how she ever learned this trick, always knowing what to say with the girls. Girls? He winces at the plural.
This is for Anna, remember, to keep our chins up for when Anna comes home. Yes?
Barbara is wiping Jenny's face with a tissue as the doorbell goes. Henry shuffles through in his socks to find the vicar in a waxed jacket and Wellingtons.
I won't come in. Mud.
He is smiling.
Nice idea to set up some seating, Henry. I just wanted to show you the little reading I've planned. Nothing too churchy, as we agreed. Just something uplifting and positive. And then I thought that perhaps you would like to say a few words, Barbara. You know, to thank everyone for their support, and to ask the local press to keep up the appeal for witnesses, that any little thing may help.
Barbara smiles, and Henry watches Jenny disappear upstairs to fetch her new coat, before suddenly calling to them from the landing window.
Look! Look out of the window, guys! You have to see this! Come up here!
The vicar, stirred by her sudden excitement, removes his wellies after all, and follows Henry and Barbara up the stairs, where there is a clear view of the narrow lane to the farmhouse. In the fading light, it is mesmerizing. A thin line of all manner of lights weaving their way along the track. Lanterns and candles and torches too, all glowing a trail in the shadows. Henry surprises himself. His lip is trembling. He watches the lights flickering and pictures Anna running ahead of him, pink gingham school dress beneath her coat, a posy in her hand. Kathy, the family liaison officer, will be here soon, and he realizes that it has all gone on long enough. He is going to have to talk to the police. He is going to have to tell everyone the truth. Chapter 12, The Private Investigator.
Matthew is making little pyramids from sugar sachets as DC Melanie Sanders enters the coffee shop, checking her watch. He has never been able not to fidget. It drives Sal mad. Right now he has challenged himself to have 3 pyramids standing at any one time. As soon as one collapses, he must make a new one before he tries to repair the old one. The table has a bit of a wobble on, adding to the uncertainty, and he is enjoying himself so much that he feels a ridiculous, childish pang of disappointment as he realizes he has to stop.
Sorry to trouble you at the weekend, Mel. He stands and kisses her on the cheek, trying not to watch as the pyramids collapse with the movement of the table.
It's okay, I'm working actually.
She is staring at the sugar sachets. 4 suddenly flush on the overtime budget. Matthew gathers up his debris and places the sachets back in the stainless steel stand at the center of the shiny, wipe-down surface.
No, we have D.I. Halfwit down from London on the case you're so mysteriously interested in. I'm babysitting.
She raises her arm for the waitress and glances behind the counter before ordering a cappuccino.
So, you've warmed to him, then?
Melanie pulls a face and pokes out her tongue. Matthew can feel his smile,
It is so good to see Mel. She was one of the few coppers at training college who refused to drink instant coffee, too. Produced a little cafetiere on the first day. They both got teased mercilessly. When they worked together, she had an app on her phone to identify the nearest cafes with proper espresso machines. Their perfect breakfast was chip butties and good Italian coffee. Matthew stares at her and realizes how much he misses it. Not just working with Mel, working on the force, the sense of team, of collaboration. This.
Okay, Matt, so are you going to tell me now what's really going on, because I haven't got much time.
She is widening her eyes now.
The DI is down to speak to the ballads again. Fresh stuff from the TV appeal, I'm assuming. They're not telling me much yet, of course, but I'm taking the family liaison officer out there straight after this. What's going on? I really need to know why you're interested, Matt.
Matthew glances around the coffee shop and then produces from his pocket an evidence bag containing a postcard and envelope. Melanie turns it over to read the message and frowns before glancing back at him for an explanation. It was sent to Ella Longfield, the witness on the train, the flower shop woman. She called me in. There were two previous very similar cards that she threw away, unfortunately. Random postmarks, Lisgard, somewhere in Dorset, and London.
And she didn't think to come to us?
Trust me, I said the same Mel from the off, but she seemed convinced they were from Anna's mother, Barbara Ballard, and she didn't want her to get in trouble. Feels guilty. Melanie lets out a long sigh as the waitress brings over her coffee.
You don't change. This should have been handed in straight away.
Don't be unfair. This is what I do now, Mel, and you wouldn't have this at all if I hadn't persuaded Ella. Anyway, we both know it's more likely to be a crank than any kind of lead.
Is that your gut, Matt? A crank?
She had quite a bit of trouble on social media after her name got out.
Yeah, a bit of a cock-up, that.
Matthew is checking Melanie's face as she turns the evidence bag over to examine the back.
We really don't know how it got out, Matt, honestly. But there's been a lot of noise upstairs about it. Press office furious.
Anyway, we put quite a lot of time into investigating the hassle, to reassure her, trying to make amends. But the feeling back then was it was likely just trolls or kids, maybe Anna's school friends. Unpleasant, but nothing significant or linked to the inquiry. Or the two guys on the train.
So you think this is the same? Just some nut trying to frighten her?
I don't know. Quite a lot of effort put into this. She is examining the card more carefully.
Doubt we'll get any prints now, but we'll try. Run it through the system. Probably just a random nutter.
So, talk. Why does this Ella think it could be the mother?
Matthew tells her about Ella visiting Cornwall, the fracas.
And she didn't think to tell us about that either.
Great.
I don't think it's the mother. I talked to her, Mel.
Jesus, Matt, this is a live investigation.
And like I say, you wouldn't have this handed in at all if it weren't for me.
Melanie dips her finger into the froth of her coffee.
I'm not looking forward to explaining this to D.I. Halfwit.
You're right, most likely another troll, but he won't like not being told.
What's his problem then, this D.I.? Doesn't sound as if they've got very far.
He's an arrogant pain, looks about 12. Wouldn't mind that if he were halfway competent, but he seems distracted by some new Soho murder case. Also, he seems to think I'm his personal chauffeur every time they're down here, which isn't often.
So, could you be vague when you hand this over? Help me out.
Keep your name out of it, you mean?
Matthew tilts his head and feigns puppy eyes.
I know I'm a stuck record, but you should have stayed in the force, Matthew. You know that, I know that, so you can stop with the butter wouldn't melt.
Matthew does not reply. Melanie is one of the few people who knows why he really left the force.
Come on then, share. What did you make of the mother, Matt? The family liaison officer reckons she's straight.
I agree. I don't think she sent them. She didn't slip up. I implied it was hate mail and she talked about them as letters, not postcards. But there's something not right there, Mel.
What do you mean?
She pretended to want to call her husband, but I could tell from the body language that she didn't really want him there at all. Bit odd.
Melanie narrows her eyes again.
So what's the deal with the parents, Mel? Are they really both in the clear? And what's come out of the TV appeal? Anything promising?
I tell you what, How about we talk about you becoming a dad instead? Much more interesting.
Chapter 13. The Witness.